There are a number of other yogic paths that are available for consideration. For example, the path of devotion or the heart. Here one uses the strength of one's own relationship skills and the quality of the yearning of the heart to be with the beloved or to have a lover or be in a love relationship. But instead of the lover being a fellow human being, the lover in this case becomes God or spirit or the higher self. I, for example, have spent time with Anandamayi Ma, who's a very beautiful woman, very high saint in India. She's a great bhakti, B-H-A-K-T-I, a bhakti or a devotional yogi. And she feels the presence of God, of the spirit, and she is in a relationship to that spirit as if she were in the relationship to a beloved. So much of the day she would sit and she would just be in that intimate relationship with her lover. And she would sing, Jaya Bhagwan, hail to the Lord, hail to the Lord. And she would do it like a love song. It would be like, Jaya Bhagwan, 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 Jaya Bhagwan. She would just sing this tender, intimate song, and when you were in her presence, you just began to feel like you were privy to pillow talk between somebody and their lover. But the quality of bhakti or devotion goes beyond that emotional quality of devotion into a deeper quality of intimacy. It's a little difficult to describe, but when you do chanting, for example, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. You are honoring Ram, in that case, another form of God. It's still singing to the beloved. The way devotional practices work is they start a little bit in your head where you're thinking about, I love you, God, I am honoring you, God. Then the experience moves into where you're listening to the sound and you're trying to make it pretty and full, and that's almost like an aesthetic. And then it moves down into the heart where it is a tremendously emotionally pulling relationship where you're just feeling the thickness of the love for God and the pain of separation. It's like foreplay. It's just such intimate relational quality. And then it goes beyond that until the Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. It's as if you tune in to an intimacy between the lover and the beloved, or the two and the one, or dualism and non-dualism. I mean, I'm really giving you a lot of metaphysical stuff in a very condensed form. But you tune in to that fine line. It's at the moment in, say, sexuality, where you are about to go into the involuntary component of orgasm, and you stay just short of that. It's right at the point between the voluntary and the involuntary. You get in so close, you don't merge with the beloved, because then you lose the beloved. Because when the dualism ends and you enter into non-dualism, there's no longer any experience. That's like going into what in Buddhism is called nirvana, where you go into the place beyond the separation between the experiencer and that which is experienced. And for many bhakti or devotional yogis, they really don't want to go beyond that place. They don't want to finish the journey and become enlightened because they have to, at that moment, give up that experience of the separation and the rapture of that relationship. In cataloging or chronicling the various forms of yoga, besides the work with energy, which is called Hatha Yoga, the work with the heart, which is called Bhakti Yoga or devotional yoga, there are two other yogas that we can attend to next, which are Jnana Yoga and Dhyan Yoga. And these are yogas that work with the mind, because the intellect is one of the most powerful tools that we as human beings have, the prefrontal lobes we have, which allows us to plan and conceptualize and abstract. These give us incredible control and mastery in our universe. They allow us to stand on the moon. They allow us to have technology that eases the burdens of our life. We're learning, of course, that the intellect, uncontrolled, not balanced by wisdom, often creates as much suffering as it does relieve it, but that's something that we're maturing to an understanding. But at any rate, we can take this powerful tool, the mind, and use it in the service of our spiritual development in the same way that we worked with our heart. And for some people, that will be the most attractive path. To understand the predicament, let me quote from a Zen master, Yasutani. He said, "Our true nature is beyond all categories. Whatever you can conceive or imagine is but a fragment of yourself. Hence, the real you cannot be found through logical deduction or intellectual analysis or endless imagining." So here we have developed our skill to think, which has given us power in the universe. Now the question is, how do you take this instrument of thinking and use it to go beyond thinking? In other words, the question is, how do you use the mind to go beyond the mind? And what is it you find when you do that? This is a very complex issue to discuss, and we can only make a very brief introduction to it here. Some of the ways that are used in carrying out this using the mind to beat the mind are, for example, the koan in Zen Buddhism. The koan, like what is the sound of one hand clapping, which the Zen master gives you a problem that is not soluble by your rational mind. And every time you try to solve it with your intellect, he hits you with a stick and laughs at you. I've been through this training and it's absolutely humiliating. And then after a while, your mind gives up and you move into what might be called the intuitive heart mind. In Chinese, it's called the Sin Sin, H-S-I-N, H-S-I-N, the heart mind. You move into another way of being where you're not mediating information through your analytic intellectual mind. I remember in my koan training being given a koan by the master. And for many days, he kept rejecting every answer I gave. Until one moment when I was walking in to see him, I experienced the futility that nothing I could think of was going to provide the answer. And I gave up and I decided I really didn't give a damn. I just didn't care. And I walked and he said, "Ah, doctor, how you know your Buddha nature? Through sound of tree and wind." And I said, "Good morning, Roshi," because I just didn't care anymore. That was my response. And he said, "Ah, Now you are becoming beginning student of Zen. And at that moment I realized I started to meet him beyond the intellect. There is a quote from Dogen Zenji that says, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. To be enlightened by all things is to remove the barrier between self and other. Can you hear in which it starts with study, and then it takes you beyond dualism, beyond the intellect? You see, the predicament with the intellect is when you think about things. So you're always in the relationship of subject to object. You think about something. And what you're moving towards is being in a relationship to the universe of subject to subject, where there's only an I left. It's all I. There's no boundaries any longer. There's no separation between you and other. And Dogen Zenji describes that sequence where as you move out of the dualism or the separation between self and other, you come into a relationship in the universe where you understand everything from inside itself, not just from outside. You don't understand it any longer just as an object, but as subject. As long as you stay in your thinking mind, you're always one thought away from where the action is. You're always cut off. There's always the subtle sense of alienation. And isn't it interesting that the thinking mind, which is this great, powerful tool we have, when we get identified with our thinking mind, we cut ourselves off from the universe and we start to starve because we're not feeding our spirit. And it's only when you have transcended the identification with the thinking mind that you then can use the thinking mind as a servant where it doesn't take over and catch you in itself. As I think Vivekananda said, the thinking mind is a wonderful servant and it's a terrible master. Now, one of the ways of getting to understand the way in which we have identified with our thoughts and thus get caught in our thinking mind is through formal techniques of meditation. It's a very broad term. It involves reflection. It involves contemplation. It involves concentration. It involves mindfulness. And these are all different aspects of meditation. I want to talk here initially about concentration. If you, for example, at this moment, start to notice your breath, just notice the breath coming in and going out. Now notice it very precisely. Notice the way it begins to come in. Continues, it ends the in-breath, then there's a space between the in-breath and the out-breath, and then there is the out-breath, and then again there is a space between the out-breath and the next in-breath. Now, if I say to you, whenever you decide to sit down and practice meditation, focus on your breath and keep your awareness as much with your breath as you can. And you start to do that. You will notice that within moments after you start, your awareness will be drawn to some thought or other. Like the thought, why am I doing this? Or this won't work. Or my knee hurts. Or is anything going to happen? Or I'm meditating. Or I'm hungry, or my back hurts, or a thousand thoughts, memories, plans, all kinds of things, sensations. You hear a car go by. You hear a clock ticking. You realize you have an appointment or you have to make a phone call. And each thought that arises says, think me, I'm real, think me. And the awareness goes out and grabs a thought, and you forget you agreed for the next 10 minutes to just follow your breath. And every time you remember that you forgot, instead of getting all upset with yourself, you just bring your awareness back to your breath. What you're doing is cultivating concentration of mind. The path of meditation is to extricate awareness from identification with thought and sensation. Because the identification of your awareness with your thought and with your sensation is what keeps you stuck on one plane of reality. Your ego, after all, is a set of thoughts. It's a conceptual structure through which you filter the universe and which gives meaning to the universe. And the idea is not to destroy your ego or destroy your sensations, but to not be trapped by them. It is just changing your relationship to them so that you're able to delight in them and play with them without being entrapped by them. One of the ways that is often talked about is the way of the witness. This is spelled out in the work of Uspensky, Gurdjieff, and many other metaphysicians. It is a technique of cultivating a part of the mind which just notices what's going on. It doesn't deny what's going on. It's not like dissociation, which is a psychological defense mechanism, where you're going into a place where you're pushing away your feelings. It's merely cultivating a part of your mind that's noticing the rest of it. So that if I'm feeling a depression, I could say, I'm depressed. Or I could say, ah, there's depression. The part of me that is noticing the depression isn't itself depressed, it's just noticing. And at first, when you're depressed, it seems to fill all the space. And then you cultivate the witness, and the witness maybe fills 1% and the depression is 99%. If you keep cultivating the witness, after a while it gets to the point where the witness is 50%. And you are noticing the depression, and you're feeling the depression at the same moment. There's a part of you inside that is perfectly equanimous, that is just noticing what's going on. Ah, joy. Ah, fear. Ah, horniness. Ah, curiosity. Ah, sadness. And you watch the unfolding of the human predicament. You watch the unfolding as if you were watching the laws of nature unfold. Because your body and your personality are all part of a lawful unfolding of the way in which form works. It's nature manifesting. The question is where you are in relation to that. Are you just those natural phenomena? Or are you an awareness that is quite independent of that? And what the whole journey to enlightenment is about is starting to acknowledge and honor and recognize that part of you that is not in form, which you could call awareness, you could call spirit, you could call God. There are many names, but of course a name is a form and no name applies to it. And that's why in the Judeo-Christian tradition, God has no name. And all the names are merely fingers pointing at the moon. They're not the moon. Once you appreciate how much you are trapped by your own identification with thought, there's nothing you want more to do than escape. And it drives you on to do these things. Not because you're good or you ought to or you should, but just because you are hungry for that freedom of your awareness. To be at play in the universe without being trapped by the universe. It's interesting how you define that awareness that you finally are resting in. Because since it's no longer identified with your body or your personality, you can't really say it's somebody any longer. Maybe you could say it's nobody. So you can almost understand the spiritual journey as going into nobody training. And then you see the peculiar quality of a human incarnation, that you actually have to become somebody before you can become nobody. That you first have to develop ego, an ego structure, in order to transcend ego, so that ego becomes servant instead of master. If you try to shortcut the whole process, it doesn't work. You begin to appreciate the incredible beauty and extraordinary complexity of what the human journey is about. There's a wonderful quote from a very dear friend of mine, a Tibetan Lama named Kalu Rinpoche. This is a far quote. He said, "We live in illusion, the appearance of things, but there is a reality. We are that reality. When you understand this, you see that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything." The further I get along in the journey, the more I understand just how that is. And I realize that I am uniquely manifesting in the world, but yet I am not special. I am just awareness, and that awareness finds its multiplicity of forms to find expression in, one of which happens to be Ramdas. I'm not busy being Ramdas, I'm just busy being. And then there is Ramdas. Ramdas is my vehicle. It's the vehicle for spirit to manifest on earth. It's no better or worse than yours or anyone's. Each of us has our unique work to do. Perfectly appropriate, perfectly lawful. The job is one of finding a place to stand inside yourself where you appreciate the unfolding of the pattern and the law of the universe without being trapped by it. What you do cultivate in that process is a way of being with the universe with a sense of appreciation and reverence rather than a quality of judging. You go out in the woods and you look at rocks and streams and trees. The way in which you just appreciate them just the way they are. You don't say that elm would be better if it was an oak. But you notice the minute you get around yourself or humans, you're busy judging. More, better, less. If my mother had only been this way to me, if my lover only would, why can't I give up my on and on and on? Constantly judging, evaluating, manipulating, trying to change. And as you quiet down, you begin to feel the inherent lawful nature of the unfolding of form. And you become so appreciative of it. You stand in awe of it. You delight in it. You appreciate it as if you were looking at a beautiful play. It's like watching a sunset, except it involves all of it. It involves suffering and joy and birth and death and sickness and age and hope and fear and all of it. It's all part of the law of the universe. And you're finding a place of equanimity inside yourself from which you sit. It's as if you have a ringside seat to the most extraordinary show in the universe. And it includes you. It includes the unfolding of your karma. I mean, I am at the moment in a 57-year-old body that is gently decaying. Now, where am I in relation to it? I'm honoring it. It's my vehicle. It's like having my old Volvo. But it's not me. It's the vehicle through which I am manifesting. And because I rest in my awareness, the fact that this body is decaying and will ultimately dissolve back into dirt doesn't freak me any more than watching trees shed their leaves in autumn. Because I don't identify with this particular time-space locus. when we look beyond the types of yoga that involve working with energy, like Kundalini yoga, working with the heart, such as devotional or bhakti yoga, working with the mind in jnana or dhyan yoga, we come to another yoga that I really would like to attend to for a moment called karma yoga. This is yoga or union, coming to union through your karma, through, that is, the unfolding of your life. Another way of saying it is through the stuff that you come in contact with every day. So if, for example, you are involved in relationship with parents or with children, instead of saying, well, I can't do spiritual practices because I have children, you say, my children are my spiritual practice. If you're traveling a lot, your traveling becomes your yoga. In other words, you start to use your life as a curriculum for coming to God. And you use the things that are on your plate that are presented to you. If you have a physical abnormality, instead of this being a pathetic problem, this becomes your yoga for coming to God. So that relationships, economics, psychodynamics, all of these become grist for the mill of awakening. They all are part of your curriculum. For example, as I quiet down and I feel my connection to the universe more, I realize that I'm part of a family, I'm part of a community, I'm part of a nation state, I'm part of an ecosystem, I'm part of a species. And I recognize that part of my route through to enlightenment is to honor my involvement with each of these. So that for the past 10 years or so, I have taken care of my father, who is very old. And instead of seeing that as an obstacle that was getting in the way of my spiritual work, I saw that it was my spiritual work. And I explored through it how to honor my father properly, how to be a son to him without doing everything that his mind wanted me to do necessarily. But learning how to keep my heart open, learning how to be impeccable, learning how to do it without clinging, without attachment, learning how to do it with a quiet mind and an open heart, and learning how to recognize that he too was a soul that had taken birth. I, as a soul who had taken birth, and we meet in this birth as father and son. And as we honor the form, and live within the form, we are free through form rather than in spite of it. In other words, when I become the perfect son, I am free of form of sonness. I've learned as I become the more perfect citizen, as I become the more perfect part of an ecosystem, I am freed through my impeccability within the form. So that one looks to one's life as listening to hear what the curriculum is, of what ways to become impeccable. Because when you are sloppy in any form, it pulls on your energies, it keeps you involved. When you're impeccable, you start to merge into it and you're free of it. One of the ways in which my karma yoga is expressed is through service, in which I am involved through my work with the Seva Foundation and my work with AIDS patients, my work with dying people, my work with the homeless, and work with teenagers, work with business people, on and on, serving them, helping them in a way that I'm not caught in the role of being the helper, forcing them to be caught in the role of being the helped. But being with them in a way that is helpful so that we all grow through the process. That's taking service and making it into a yoga, which liberates everybody rather than entraps everybody in the dualism that occurs between server and served. So the journey of finding one's spiritual path leads finally to realizing that one leads a spiritual life, a life infused with the Spirit. And the way you come to fully appreciate that infusion of the Spirit is to more and more come fully into the moment, where this moment is enough. That lovely story of the man being chased by a tiger to a cliff, and he climbs down the cliff and he's holding onto a branch, and there's a tiger below the cliff, so if he lets go, he'll be eaten by the tiger below, and if he climbs back up, he'll be eaten by the tiger above. And two mice come along and start to eat at the branch he's holding on, nibble away at it. At that moment, he notices that there's a strawberry bush nearby on which there is one strawberry. He reaches out and tastes the strawberry. How sweet it tastes. The full taste of that strawberry in that moment. No past, no future, just this. Right in this moment, with its truth and its fullness and its thickness. This is the end of the journey. The journey brings you right here, fully here now. As you quiet and listen with open heart and quiet mind, the journey will unfold right before you. And it will be a journey in which there is no falling off the path, because even the experience of falling off the path is just part of the process. May you be surrounded with blessings in your journey, and may every part of your life experience feed the awakening of the Spirit. You and I are so incredibly graced to even know that there is a journey. And as we travel along together, we appreciate again and again our good fortune